and welcome to Joe's Boys. This is a podcast for little women, little men, and everyone in between. I'm your host, Peyton Thomas. I'm the author of the novel Both Sides Now. I'm also a writer for publications like Vanity Fair and the New York Times. And I'm here today with my very special guests, plural, Ray Terciero and Bree Indigo. Ray and Bree are the author-illustrator team behind Meg, Joe, Beth, and Amy, a graphic novel adaptation of Little Women that I've plugged many times on the show before. Ray is a New York Times bestselling author of many other books as well, including the award-winning Free Lunch. Bree has illustrated a number of graphic novels and comics, including most recently The Dog Knight, Ray's book North Ranger, and Something to Say, which is themed around a debate club. So as a former debate kid myself, I know we'll have a lot to talk about. Ray, Bree, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you so much. It's good to be here. I'm well. I just got back from dog walking, so I'm still a little sweaty.
Are you a dog knight in real life?
Yeah, I would say so.
Yes.
I skipped down and walked in my dog so I could be here. I mean, my husband do it.
Well, good for you. I completely support equal division of household labor, very much. And there is a dog adoption in this chapter. That very much does happen. I'm sure we'll get into it.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, Ray, Bree, what's your relationship to Little Women?
So, I mean, I was going to say, I don't want to get personal, but let's just get personal. I grew up really poor, but my abuela was always taking me to the library, and I was reading above my age group all the time. So I think it was third or fourth grade, the librarian was like, this is a book, but she was recommending it to a girl, of course.
Okay.
And I was like, what's Little Women? I want to read it. She's like, you're a boy. And I was like, and? So I read it, and there were so many books that I was reading at the time that, you know, either didn't get into poverty or didn't really talk about it, but I felt like Little Women really resonated with me because it was not for rich girls. They were struggling, and their dad was away. He was in the military, and my dad was in the military, even though I didn't grow up with him. But then, of course, I had the biggest crush on Lori.
You're like, surprise, surprise.
But Joe was my favorite sister. So again, no surprise there.
Very interesting. So I guess we might have a predictable answer for you when it comes to which Mark sister are you?
Uh-huh.
Bree, what about you? What's your relationship to Little Women?
So I was late to the fandom. I essentially only saw it in passing growing up. I surprisingly wasn't really interested in it, but then I had friends who read it and they really loved it. And then when our book, Meg, Joe, Beth, and Amy came across, I was just like, this is a perfect opportunity to read and appreciate what people love so much about it. And so for me, it was just my relationship to that is just to take a step back, appreciate something from a different perspective. So yeah, for the most part, I've been learning a lot about the story and how people absorbed it through conversations like this. And I really enjoy watching people enjoy stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I really, really enjoyed Meg, Joe, Beth, and Amy. Not only have we talked about it on this show, but other people who've come on as guests, as parents have been like, oh yeah, my kid read Little Women graphic novel where Joe is queer. And I was like, very interesting. I read that too. There's actually a couple now. You share the space with Kathleen Gross, who's also been on the show.
Everyone's coming to a hive mind. We're like,
Yes. I was saying right before I hit record, I was like, we're here. Joe's queer. That's the agenda. So Ray, actually, I'll go to Bree since Ray answered that question first. Bree, which March sister are you? And again, for the purposes of this podcast, Lori is a March sister.
Listen, I can feel and resonate with each of them. And I think that's what makes them so special to readers. I think that I resonate most with Beth.
Interesting.
I don't know. I just feel like maybe I can't articulate it as well, but I don't know. I feel the vibe. I don't know.
Well, that makes sense. We've known each other for 5 minutes, but you're like a visual artist and you have this beautiful apartment behind you. So I was like, this is giving me Amy.
And that's the thing is I pride myself on trying to balance my personality as much as possible.
Yes.
But then when it just comes to like the heart, I resonate with Beth.
Yes, the Beth heart, which very much comes through in the book. And Ray, what about you? Which March sister are you?
It's what I wanted to identify with Lori as a kid, but again, I had a crush on him. And so I think, I mean, I would be Joe because she's a writer and I always wanted to be a writer from a young age. And in a way, she inspired me. She was really pushing boundaries 150 years ago. So as a kid, I was like, it'd be cool if I wanted to write sci-fi or horror or fantasy. Mm-hmm. But I was also like, how cool would it be if there was a gay character in it?
Yeah, hush, hush, whisper, whisper.
Well, in 80s, 90s Texas, there were no gay characters.
Exactly.
In books, or at least for kids.
Yeah.
But yeah. So Jo's my girl. I still am angry that she didn't marry Lori. If you have to marry someone, marry Lori. What is going on?
And that is interesting to me. One of the interesting things about your book is you don't touch the character of Professor Bear, unless I'm mistaken. There's no Professor Bear analog, no kid version. No. In Kathleen Gross's Jo, A Little Women adaptation, sort of, which is another middle grade graphic novel adaptation, she invents a 12-year-old lesbian Professor Bear, and that's her innovation.
Yeah.
But you guys, I'm going to ask you, that's just kind of the first question. Why the decision to exclude Professor Bear? And then let's just talk about your version of, let's talk about Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy.
I mean, I feel like it was so hard because there's part one and part two of Little Women, obviously. Yeah. And when I was first thinking it up, I was like, there has to be two parts. But then at the same time, if it's a kid's book or a book for young readers, I don't want to get into marriage and weddings and all these women who are like, I have to marry so that I can be supported by a man. And I know that was of its time. It's very Jane Austen, but I don't know. It always kind of bummed me out. And I was like, I don't want to get married because my parents had a horrible relationship. Hmm. Now I am married to my husband. He's wonderful and it's great. But back then I was very against it. I forgot the question.
I was going to say, why was Professor Bear written out of the book?
Because it's mostly part one of Learn. Yeah. So there was no point in having it. And I wanted Jo to kind of be a free agent at the end of the first book.
Yep.
Yeah,
completely.
Leave the space for a sequel.
Exactly. And there you go. There we go. Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy. Two Meg, two Jo, two Beth, two Amy. Bree, maybe you can tell us. So how did this book come about? How did you start working together? What was the genesis of the project?
So it was my debut graphic novel. And essentially before that, I had been working on an independent project webcomic called Jamie on Tapas.
Which is beautiful. Check it out. So good. Thank you.
It's on hiatus right now, but I'm still working on it. It's still in my heart. But I started on that. And then Michael Son, he was editor-in-chief at Tapas, reached out and asked if I wanted to take part in this collaboration with Little Brown Books for Young Readers and Tapas. And then that's who introduced me to Rex and started, first and foremost, the whole part of my career. But then that's what got me onto the book.
Fantastic. And I just want to clarify. So Ray Terciero is also Rex Ogle.
You're
a man of many names.
Okay. I was at a time where I was just like, am I supposed to keep this a secret? I don't know.
Totally fine. I think it's even on the jacket copy.
Yes. Yeah. Ray is also Rex. So there we go. And so, I mean, Ray, Rex, do you want to tell the people a little bit about Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy and what they can expect when they read it?
It's such a work of love. I wrote dozens of books in my 20s and 30s. I was always trying to get published. I moved to New York City with a duffel bag and $200 and was like, I'm going to be a writer. But I was always scared of being poor, so I always had a job. But I was like, if I have to have a job, I'm going to work in publishing. So I worked at Marvel Comics, DC Comics, Scholastic, and then finally Little Brown. And the whole time, again, I just wanted to write my own stories. It wasn't happening. But then Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy was the 100. I was working at Little Brown, who was the original publisher of the original Little Women. And I was like, the 150th anniversary is coming up. Y'all need to do something. And they're like, it's been reprinted so many times. And I was like, no, I meant something new, something fresh, a different. You with it. Have fun. Yeah. So, and then I was just like, and let's make it queer.
They're like, well, I did come up with the idea. So,
yes. I mean, you say make it queer. I think the original is very queer, as we will discuss.
Yes. Yeah.
But your Jo goes on a whole coming out journey. The other thing that's really unique about your book is that the March family is a blended family and they're a multiracial family, which isn't something that I'd seen in. I've seen adaptations where the March family was kind of ported to different cultures. We had Hannah Kahn on the show talking about her book, More to the Story, where the Marches are a Muslim family. But what was the decision behind making the Marches multiracial and making Lori a person of color?
I mean, I'm half Mexican and gay, and I grew up in Texas. And I mean, it's not the same as being Black. I can imagine, because I know that our country has a horrible history of mistreating Black people, and mistreating is not even the right word because it's horrible. But growing up in Mexican and Texas, I experienced racism. People were always like, why aren't you washing dishes? Swim back to your country.
Jesus.
They called me refried beans. I mean, it was...
I'm not even good with the name calling either.
Yeah, come on. Nah,
kids are cruel, but to be fair, they were inventive. I was like, I've got to respect
that.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I don't know. I always grew up at watching Star Trek and reading X-Men, and those were such diverse casts. And I was always so impressed with these found family people who work together. And because they have different backgrounds, they're better than the individuals. They're better as a whole. So with Meg, Jo Beth, and Amy, I really wanted a diverse cast, but I wanted to push the boundaries. And so when I read Jamie from Bree, I was just like, I want to partner with her and let her bring her experience to the book. And all the hair stuff, I don't know anything about females' hair, and I certainly don't know anything about women of color's hair. So, I mean, I was constantly calling Bree and be like, is this okay? What about this? How about this?
I mean, I was even making decisions where I was just like, can Meg sport a different hairstyle every chapter? Is this realistic? I wanted to.
Yeah, I think that is, first of all, that last point. Absolutely. We see Meg trying on a new hairstyle on page chapter 2. She's like, all right, let's go with these curls.
Yeah.
Let's have a hot iron mishap. That's very Black.
And the thing is also though, but there's also the aspect that hair care in the Black community is so expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you can't do it yourself. So I always imagine that she was just so good at taking care of herself that she just taught herself to do it.
Yeah.
Because it is possible, but it's hard. Oh my gosh.
Yes. Yeah. Listen, I have, you can't tell today, but I do have very fine curly hair.
Ooh.
And it sort of deflates if I don't do anything to it. And I'm trying to be on my curly girl journey, but it's not easy.
Oh my God. Same. So, I'm too lazy to get a haircut. And now my hair curling. It's these little wings on the side of my head under my hat.
Ray and I are both wearing ball caps, which is the sign that we've given up.
I was wearing one just before turning on the camera. I put on a bow in case I was like, do I look bald? I was like,
no, it looks great. Yeah. It looks great.
No, I completely feel you. And only in my 30s have I finally now have the money, the time, and the patience to learn my curls. Because growing up, my mother was great. She's white, but she always did her very best. She was just like, your hair is beautiful. People do so much to get your hair. Your hair is unique. Your hair is special. And and then she would just be like, and I really don't know how to take care of it, but here, you look beautiful. And I chopped it off when I was in high school because it wasn't anything aggressive, but people would just do stuff like put their hands in my hair. I had a friend who blew hot pockets into my hair.
What?
Because I was like, blew hot air into my hair because it wouldn't escape.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, that's so funny. But now I'm just like, dude, my hair has never been respected. And so I cut it off and now I'm finally growing it back out and it's at chin length.
Yeah. It looks very cute.
Thank you
for clarifying what you meant by blowing hot pockets into your hair, because I was like the microwavable snack.
But yeah, I'm very lucky.
Would have been preferable.
I'm very lucky because my first girlfriend in sixth grade was Black. And I think when I first met her, I was like, I love your hair. And she was like, don't ever touch it. And I was like, what? And she was like, white people are always touching Black people's hair. Don't ever do that to me or anybody else without consent.
And in general, that's just a consent lesson, period, right? It shouldn't be special to Black people and their hair, but that's a whole deeper conversation.
Yes. It really is. Yes. I know. I mean, it's highly relevant because Meg is sporting fabulous hairstyles in every single page of Meg, Jo Beth, and Amy. And that's completely in line with how she is in the book. And so let's get to the book. Let's get to the final chapter of Little Women. This is a very special episode. It's our final episode of Joe's Boys.
Yeah.
We've come to the conclusion of Little Women. And today we are going to be discussing chapter 47, Harvest Time. So Ray, Bree, on this august occasion, would you like to recap this chapter for us?
Oh my gosh, I'm terrible at recapping. Rex, you're the writer.
Okay. It's the finale. Aunt March dies suddenly. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it was so funny because Aunt March died suddenly. I'm like, how did she die? Who knows? But she dies and she leaves. What is her house called? Plumfield, I think.
Plumfield.
Mm-hmm. She leaves it to Joe. And Joe is like, I no longer have to worry about writing, which we'll get to that. But then she's like, I'm going to open a boys' home, which is what I've always wanted. And I think it's just her talking with her family about it. And then I think it cuts to, and the school is open, and they're all much older, and everyone is hanging around with the March mom, and she's just surrounded by her kids, her grandkids, all these essentially adopted boys at the boys' home. And
in the quadroon.
And in the very last line, oh, my girls, however long you may live, I never can wish you a greater happiness than this. Which
so
is a beautiful ending. but I found problematic because A, I didn't like Joe getting married to some weird German. B, she stopped writing, which I was like, yeah, you've wanted to write your whole life. What the?
Okay, I'm just glad that I'm not alone where I was just like, unhappy.
And then I guess my third point is, why open a boys' home? Why not a girls' home?
That was a question that, yeah, that I had.
I had another point, but I can't remember it. So
sorry.
Yeah, so very interesting end chapter here. Lots to go over the points. I could pick in any one of the 5,000 points we just raised, and that could be our entry point. Mm-hmm. But I just want to first say, last episode, I did the Under the Umbrella chapter with Willow Caitlin McClay, and we were just like, thank God this is not the last chapter. And it doesn't end on this proposal with Professor Bear and this just miserable walk in the rain. We do get something after it. And what's remarkable is that after the last chapter, when Joe and Professor Bear declare their love for one another, love, air quotes, immediately Professor Bear is no longer, he's like, anyway, Professor Bear was off across the country. And then Joe got this school and she wants to talk to Lori about it. I'm like, that, very good. Okay, so Professor Bear does come back, but he is not a primary character in the end. We got a lot of kind of Meg and John Brooks' married life. We got a lot of Amy and Laurie's married life. And Bear is really a pretty, he's here for sure, but he's, compared to those two, he's a much more marginal presence,
yeah,
which I appreciate because I don't like Professor Bear.
My guess is that Joe and him are each other's beards.
A setup so that Joe can follow her passions, whatever they are.
Yep. And yeah, the German professor goes on these business trips. You're a teacher. What are you doing business outside of town?
He does. He and Joe are like, let's get married. He's like, yeah, I just have to go to California first. And she's like, yeah, for sure. Let's just not talk for a year.
He went to San Francisco. Let's be honest.
He went to San Francisco.
Hey, different kinds of marriages.
For a year, Joe and her professor worked and waited, hoped and loved, met occasionally, and wrote such voluminous letters. So they're not anyway, so Professor Bear is not in the picture for this conversation about Plumfield, which is interesting. She's like, so what I'm going to do with the rest of my life without consulting my husband is open this school.
Yeah.
I mean, at the time, I'm sure that was screaming independence. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So. Exactly. Well, when you say they're each other's beards, what Alcott said about the decision to marry Joe to Bear, she said she had gotten all these letters from girls who read the first book and were like, who are the Little Women going to marry? When are Joe and Lori going to get married?
Yeah.
And Alcott was like, I'm not going to marry Joe to Lori to please anyone. It's not happening. What I'm going to do instead is make a funny match for Joe, and I expect heaps of wrath to be poured on my head. And she was right. It's
real. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
So she was doing it on purpose. Yeah. She was like, this is a weird match. And it's my least favorite part of the book, for sure. I think the greatest innovation, you guys were just like, let's just get rid of him. And that's so valid.
Bye.
Yeah. And then the great innovation of Greta Gerwig's film was, with all these other film stage adaptations, there was this third act problem because we're kind of plodding toward this relationship that no one cares about.
Yeah.
And what she did with her timeline bending was, we're going to get Professor Bear out of the way right away.
Yeah.
And then at the end, he'll come back as a fantasy. I'm going to make it clear that the marriage is a concession that she's making to make a profitable book. So all kinds of things people have done with Professor Bear, but most notably, Professor Bear is hardly in this chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The emphasis is on Joe and on her dream of having this boys' school. Mm-hmm. And to the point you mentioned earlier about found family, she's like, it's a boys' school, but they're essentially adopting these boys. And she has a giant crowd of boys. And it sounds like the entire extended March family is all involved in raising them because the students make presents for Marmee, yeah, right? And Lori's around. Lori is composing music for the kids to sing at a school ceremony. Everyone is really involved. In the sequels, I understand Lori is going to open up a college right next to Plumfield called Lawrence College. And so everyone's just going to live on this big campus. So the dream of Joe being a writer is kind of superseded by this dream of Joe being a teacher,
mm-hmm,
and being surrounded by boys.
Yes.
Let's get back to that again, because you said, why not a girls' school? Why? Tell me why. Was that your
I mean,
your
I just here? Felt, I guess because it's called Little Women, and yeah, I always just thought these were four girls whose mom was really struggling, and they had to make ends meet, and they lost their sister to illness, and I was just surprised. I don't know, or maybe yeah, I didn't know why boys home, because now that I'm thinking about it, it makes perfect sense. Because, I mean, Louisa May Alcott herself said essentially that she was born in the wrong body. So whether she was a lesbian or she was transgender, but they didn't have the vocabulary at the time, she probably couldn't come out because that was a career ending. But it's, yeah, I guess it is okay. Not that it's, there's no good or bad, but I see why she opened a boys' school.
Okay. And Bree, you're raising your hand. Yeah. So the way that when I brushed up on the chapter, the way that they talk about little boys is not about raising them to be strapping young trad men or anything like that.
Yeah.
It sounded like she was trying to nurture the gentler side of them so that they could be well-balanced young men. And in a way, if I can get into her head, maybe if she's not writing, but she is writing, she is raising these people, she's doing more hands-on change than she might imagine her books will do. I mean, I don't have to agree. I don't have to agree, but perhaps that's where she is.
That's really cool. I love that.
Yeah. I mean, she's just having a more direct impact. I've noticed in myself at 30 that I still really want to be a storyteller because I'm not going to have children. My books are going to essentially share my values and how I would raise the child if I had one. And so maybe it was similar to that as well. Maybe that's what they were imagining. I do agree, though. I kind of wish that it was just a general school, right?
Yeah.
Why boys specifically? But it was still a nice sentiment. I was laughing at the quadroon, though. I was like, bro.
So for anyone unfamiliar, I'm not going to say that word.
It's okay. I mean, it's,
that is a
it's the
very
word.
antiquated term for a person who is one quarter black.
Yeah.
And so Joe admits a student who's one quarter black. And it says here that there had been a lot of hoo-ha about
letting them in.
Let's see. There was a merry little quarter black boy who could not be taken in elsewhere, but who was welcome to the Bear Garden, though some people predicted that his admission would ruin the school.
Mm-hmm.
And that is grounded in the actual fact that Louisa May Alcott's father had a very successful school in Boston, and he chose to admit black students along with white students.
Yeah.
And it was a catastrophe in that white parents started pulling their kids out of the school. And rather than reverse the decision and expel the black students, Alcott just kept through to the very end until the school wasn't financially viable anymore and it foundered. So that's very much from life. And
it's just the value that it has in community is more important than its quote-unquote success as a business or whatever. Because even someone even brought up, this doesn't sound very profitable. It's like, that's not the point.
Well, it's not very profitable, but in fact, it never was a fashionable school and the professor did not lay up a fortune. They don't have money.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the understanding of how this is going to work financially is Jo gets this inheritance from her very rich aunt.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Lawrence, Lori's grandfather, is kind of giving them money to help raise the kids. So it's like being funded by charity.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And and good vibes.
Yeah. And profit is not the point.
Yeah.
Definitely, though, they have a vegetable patch. They have an orchard. So they're that's another reference to one of Bronson Alcott, Lou's father's failed ventures. He wanted to do a utopian agrarian commune without ever having farmed before. And that did not go so well.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Joe is like, I'm going to have a school that's it's multi-ethnic. In fact, this is only character of color that appears on the page in Little Women.
Yeah.
And it's just two quick references to this boy who comes to the school, and the school goes on just fine with him in the student body. He sings well. That's kind of
the story to be believable for the time. You have to understand that was still for the time that was radical.
Yeah, it was. And Alcott was very much on the side of abolition. The Alcotts, their home was at one point a stop on the Underground Railroad. They were in this fight. So you kind of reading Little Women, you wish that what was the Civil War about? Why is Dad at the Civil War? You wish that was more prominent. This is sort of, it's a little crumb, the very end of the book.
You have to be able to digest.
And Alcott has written other things where abolition and slavery are much more prominent.
Yeah.
Hospital Sketches being a principal example, but that shows up here. We should get back to the question of why a boys' school. And because girls went to school. We see Amy at this time going to school, and schools for genteel women were a thing. Public education, I don't know if public education was a national mandate, but it was going to be soon. But it's interesting that she says, boys, I want to open a school for little lads. And it's never a conversation about, okay, are you going to admit girls as well? Why not a girls' school? And it's funny that there are a lot of very good feminist objections to the end of Little Women, but they have more to do with Professor Bear and Joe being married than at the conclusion of this book about girlhood and women. It's like, well, I'm going to open a boys' school.
Yeah.
And girls can pound sand.
Perhaps to piggyback off of what I brought up earlier, Joe is going about raising them in a different way.
Men raised by women are certainly different than men raised by men. So,
Yes. Perhaps it's just about raising a different type of boy, boy who's in touch with femininity a bit differently. She has a lot of fresh ideas. She's literally trying to raise the next generation of young men who are hopefully going to make a more inclusive world for others. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Because men raised by women are men raised by men.
And it's not like she was just like, time to raise these boys like women. No, it was, she even judges like, this is your role model. Do you know what I mean? It's this person is great and cares about the community, cares about us. We care about each other. That's what's important is this give and take as opposed to what they can take from others.
Exactly. Yeah. And Lori being kind of the example that she points to is notable to me because Lori is someone who was miserable in all male single sex environment and came into the March family and was just completely 180 improved and changed by his proximity to the March family and from getting to grow up with girls and play girls games and be a part of their world. So it's not as though she's like, we're going to turn Plumfield into a gym and everyone's going to be pumping iron every
day. I mean, it's an introducing men to the, what I've noticed as a queer person that looks at hetero relationships, there's a balance there and I don't know why they can't strike it. And it's just, boys do deserve to have nurturing environments. Yes. Everyone thrives when they're nurtured. It doesn't mean spoiled. Yeah. So, you know, Lori learned that and he got to benefit from it. It's literally about the importance of diversity in your community.
Yes. An important part of the feminist project is raising boys who will respect women, support women, not perpetuate the patriarchy. And I think that's something that's definitely happening here. And also, I mean, from just a very practical standpoint, going back to Lou Alcott as the author of this passage, right? Alcott is someone who said, I feel as though I am by some freak of nature, a man's soul put into a woman's body. Ian said earlier, she said essentially that she was in the wrong body. She said that. She said that explicitly in the 1800s. And that's not the only instance of her saying she wants to be a man. She says, when she was asked to write Little Women, she says, I never liked girls. And it wasn't sometimes her identification with men wanting to be a man. It could tilt into misogyny, even when she was a suffragist trying to drum up support for women's voting rights in Concord in Massachusetts. She would be like, these women only want to bake cookies. They don't want to vote. They won't come out of the meetings because they're so busy cooking. And I'm like, okay, I'll call it. But
she was ahead of, her time, essentially. It's just she was looking past what does it mean for a woman, quote unquote, what that means today to be an equal as opposed to
exactly.
a human being who happens to be
and
a
I
woman.
Think, I mean, I call her misogynist for doing that. But it's also, she was surrounded by women who were quite comfortable with the status quo and didn't necessarily...
They just wanted more of their
peace. Wanted more of their peace, were very happy to uphold white supremacy, right? It's, she had her grievances with the way that women were sort of being complicit in their own situation, right? So... But also just from a purely practical standpoint, she always wanted to be a boy and she never liked girls or felt like a natural fit getting along with them. Her closest friendships were always with boys and with men. It's significant that when she was asked to write a girl's book, she wrote about herself and her sisters because those were sort of the only girls that she felt close to. And it occurs to me that as Little Women winds to a close, and this book was a major, major commercial success right from the jump. The sequel followed less than a year later from the original. She's putting herself in a situation where she's like, if I have to write more of these, I want them to be about boys because I don't like writing about girls. And so the next book in the series was Little Men, and then it was Joe's Boys, and the stories could focus on boys. So it is odd. It's weird that Joe's vision of what she wants her school to be isn't, I want boys and girls to be learning together, or I want to start a feminist academy where girls can learn to do all kinds of things. It's, I want a boys' school.
So to, I have a couple of points because we, I think you mentioned, organize my thoughts. So I know you had said she's kind of misogynist, but when I think about my own gender and stuff, I've even questioned myself, am I non-binary? Why am I non-binary? Am I non-binary because I don't relate to anything of what it means to be male or female? Do I just reject the concept of gender altogether? At what point was she just responding to a misogynistic world? Yeah. As in, and again, I'm not trans, so this is why I'm asking. Was it just a heavy reaction to that environment? And then internally, it's just like, well, the only way that any of this can change is men changing, because they rule the world at this point. You know what I mean? If the person, quote unquote, at the top changes, then everything changes beneath it as well. Yeah. I don't know how comfortable I am thinking about her as a misogynist.
When I say misogyny, I'm really referring to the comments that she made about the women who wouldn't sign up for the suffrage club and being like, I guess they just want to stay home and make cookies. Okay, girl.
Oh, got you. Yeah, it definitely seemed like she was ahead of her time.
Yeah, and saying, I don't like girls. I never liked girls. That some of that is her discomfort with being a girl, right?
Because I felt that way too growing up. I was just like, I'm only friends with boys because I think that was kind of the point I was trying to make before I lost it, is that boys are just given more freedom in this and that in the world at the time. Obviously, we have our own problems today, but I'm just speaking about that time. Of course, you would grow if you cared at all and you didn't feel these restrictions on you just for your gender or your sex. It's not logical. It doesn't make any sense. So if that's your idea of male and female, then of course you would feel like a male if you just had any spirit of wanting to be more than what you're allowed to be.
Well, that's very true. And then Lou Alcott also did explicitly say, I want to be a man. I'm a man's soul in a woman's body.
Right.
It's okay. There's a lot going on here.
No, I didn't know that. Yeah. That makes sense.
And she said because she's fallen in love with so many pretty girls and never won
the least little bit least with any bit man. With, yeah. So that's certainly, that's a part of it.
Yeah. I do wonder if we look back at 150 years ago and we have privilege now that people 150 years ago did not have. And so it's hard for us to put ourselves in those shoes because, I mean, I can't imagine in a way Alcott was a revolutionary by writing just Joe's character. Yes. Where now we can write openly LGBTQ+ characters and it's... We live in a different world, so we have so much more privilege. Yeah.
What's interesting, though, I think for the time, I think Joe is a very openly queer character. Joe says on page one, I can't get over my disappointment in not being a boy. Joe expresses attraction to women in this book several times. Joe is cross-dressing as a boy and playing a romantic lead against girls, right? That's all in this book. And if we think about even just the time period this was in, Alcott was saying, publicly talking about feeling like a man's soul in a woman's body. If we go up the road a little bit to New York, Walt Whitman was very out and proud and writing poetry and getting all kinds of shit for it. His mentor was Emerson, who Alcott was friends with, right? Emily Dickinson was a little ways into Western Massachusetts, having a lesbian relationship there, writing poetry about that, writing poetry about identifying as a man. Or when we think of the past as this buttoned up thing, even the Civil War environment, Albert Cashier was a Civil War soldier who lived as a man before and after the Civil War and was only discovered to be having been born a woman upon his death, right? So people were living these lives and these feelings were being expressed in all kinds of literature, including in Little Women, well before we had labels like gay or lesbian or certainly trans. But those labels aren't as old as you might think. Right. There are places where... Alcott makes a joke about tribbing, which is that's lesbian behavior. That's an antiquated word. It's like for tribetism, which is the antiquated word for that. And so that's elsewhere in the Alcott canon. There's Alcott short stories where she's writing about cross-dressing and men who are curiously drawn to other men, right? It's all here. Yeah. And I think what we're doing is not so much what you did in your book was let's have Joe say it and come out and be a lesbian and just own that proudly. And then what we're doing on this podcast when we read carefully is, oh, this has all been there. We're kind of just excavating it and taking our little archaeologist brushes and going like, here it is.
I mean, that's how queer people had to exist. And historically, you couldn't be found out at sometimes. You had to pass if you were going to live that life. And then there are alternative lifestyles. I read a story. It was an article and it was about a man who's like in his 70s now and he has a new husband. But then he talked about how his past marriage was essentially he married a woman and his partner married a woman and the women were dating and they lived together in a house and raised two kids. And I'm just like, alternative living.
Yeah.
They had to. And the only reason they did that is because they had to be each other's beards. Mm-hmm. But now, in his second marriage, he can just marry the man he loves. Yep. And it's just very sweet and interesting.
What time period would that have been that they were, you know,
It was maybe the 80s or something like that. It wasn't very long ago.
Even going in the 1880s, which is only a little ways after, that was kind of the prime time of the Boston Marriage, which I'm not talking about Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. I'm talking about I'm talking about women who lived together and they were kind of each other's primary partners. Some of them were lesbians, what we'd call lesbians today. Some of them were just BFFs and lived together and were like, I'm not interested in marrying a man, honestly. I want to enjoy my independence. I want to live with another woman. And that was maybe Alcott never married, right? Alcott continued to kind of live in her community and live with her family. She adopted her sister's children. So she had even kind of a non-traditional third act, right? So
it just goes to show that there's places for queer individuals in society.
Yes.
Even though we're told constantly, oh, there's no point for you. Yeah. There's no point for you. I'm just like, how is that the case when straight people abandon so many children all the time? Someone has to raise them. No.
In a very real sense, people have just always been queer and trans.
If queer and trans people didn't have a place in this world, it wouldn't exist.
And Walt Whitman got in a ton of shit for writing openly gay poetry, but he was still a wildly commercially and critically successful poet. Alcott, Little Women was banned by the Christian Union when it came out for the Christmas play chapter, which is the one where Joe cross-dresses and plays a love interest to women. And the Christian Union, they wrote to the editor of Little Women, were like, can Alcott take that chapter out? And Alcott was like, no. So
they really love to cancel.
I would love to keep it in. And so these conversations about queer content in books, we've been having them, right? So
yeah.
I should clarify, we don't know that was the principal objection because that chapter also talks about witchcraft and suicide and murder. So
She went heavy. She went heavy.
But yeah, this is a queer book, and I think the ending of it, as much as we hate that she marries Professor Bear, we don't have to see the wedding. We don't have to see we understand that babies have been made. We don't see them be getting made. You know, and as much she has her own kids, but she's also, there's not much of a distinction drawn between her own biological children and the children that she's teaching at this school and that she's raising in community. And in so many ways, this is an expression of this utopian communal vision that her father had, right? Coming at the end of Little Women. There's alternate ways to be a family, right? Being a blood relative isn't everything. Marriage certainly isn't everything because they all kind of wind up being married to each other.
Commitment goes beyond labels.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm happier leaving the book on this note than if the last chapter had been the final chapter and it was in Joe and Professor Bear went off into the sunset.
Oh, my God.
Because she does get a happy ending. She gets to be with her family. She gets to fulfill the dreams of raising all these boys. Yep. I mean, it's a happy, I mean, I always wanted to be family when I was a kid, and she gets that.
Yeah. Yeah. What's also interesting about Alcott's gender dysphoria was it never seemed to correspond to not wanting to be a parent. She always loved kids and was like, I really want to raise kids, and was the adoptive parent of her sister's children. So there was an instance where someone kind of wrote a newspaper article that suffragists don't care about being about children or raising children. And she wrote this spitfire letter back that was like, how dare you? Raising children, telling stories for children, that's my entire life. I can be a suffragist and do that. So I think we're talking about raising children and raising boys in this really egalitarian, utopian way with a lots of women around and a lot of effort being made to make sure that boys don't grow up in destructive or violent ways, which would have been front of mind coming out of the Civil War, right?
Yeah.
I think one last thing we can talk on, and this is something you mentioned at the very beginning, right? You were disappointed that Joe doesn't wind up being a writer.
Yeah.
And how does that piece fit in here?
I mean, for me, from a very young age, I love story. I want to create stories. It was something I just knew I always wanted to do. And I felt that paralleled in Joe's character. She wanted to be a writer. She wanted to be published. Such a big deal. And then so to have her kind of just drop it in the end, it was like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
But Greta Gerwig did a great job with the end of the movie because it was kind of meta how she went to the publisher and she demanded a better advance of royalties.
She said, I should own my copyright and I want a better advance, which were things that Alcott did in her real life, was go to bat for a higher percentage of the profit and a better book deal.
Yeah.
Alcott was a very, very shrewd business person above all. And what that meant was a lot of her writing was economic for a paycheck, was getting an assignment and turning something back in. She didn't want to write for girls. I think the thing that she's best known for is maybe not the book that she's the most passionate about, right? And I think what's interesting is Jo doesn't, she's like, you know what, maybe I will write great books. Let me actually find where she says, because they talk about the wishes that they made, their castles in the air. And Jo says, yes, I remember saying that I wanted to be a writer, but the life I wanted then seems selfish, lonely, and cold to me now. I haven't given up the hope that I may write a good book yet, but I can wait, and I'm sure we'll be all the better for such experiences and illustrations as these. And that is maybe a radical viewpoint as far as, you know what, I don't have to be the prodigy who publishes a book at 25. She has already published a novel at this point. It wasn't received well. There were too many cooks in the kitchen. It wasn't her vision. And she got frustrated by that. But she's like, you know what? I can take my time. I can wait. I have some years left in me and I can write a book maybe someday. And she's, in fact, she says, I haven't given up the hope that I may write a good book yet. And I'm sure it will be, will, not if, all the better for such experiences and illustrations. So she's living.
Yes. Exactly. I can relate to that fully. So I at least understand because before 30, my creativity and my storytelling was fulfilling, but lonely because a lot of it was escapism. And now that I'm involved in my community a lot more, that community is now filling a different inspiration in me and my stories are going to look different moving forward. But right now, you have to still experience to be a writer. So she's just in a new experience that she'll digest and then put into her work.
Exactly. Yeah. So she hasn't given up, Ray. She's still going to do it.
I guess, I mean, thinking about Alcott and you saying she was a businesswoman, that resonates with me because, I mean, I want to write books. I've always wanted to write books. But also, fulfilling your dream is not easy. I'm not a millionaire. I mean, writing kids' books does not pay like... Unless you're J.K. Rowling. So it's.
And then you have to be J.K. Rowling.
And then you have to be crazy and mean and not a good person. But it's, I mean, being a business person and a creative is hard because, I mean, you want to put on the table. And so it's not that she sold out, but I think she was keeping the money coming in so she could support herself. But she was also dropping in these Easter eggs essentially for queer readers.
And even so, I'm comfortable with the way the book ends. I wish Mr. Bear were not in the picture. And it occurs to me that there's a version of this book maybe where he never shows up at all and she inherits Plumfield and starts the school. And Mr. Lawrence is fundraising it and she's just a single principal of this school. And I would have preferred that. I don't like Professor Bear. I don't like her being married to him, but... That's kind of the last objection I will raise before we draw the curtain over Jo's Boys, a Little Women podcast.
Aw, what an honor.
Thank you so much for being here. Before I wrap up and kind of I'll ask you to tell us where we can find you online, where we can get your books. I just want to take some time to just thank the people who have supported me throughout the making of this podcast. Obviously, first and foremost, our listeners. If you've listened to the show, given us a rating, given us a review, told a friend about it. Thank you for making this podcast what it was and for opening this conversation about Little Women and Louisa May Alcott and 19th century queerness and historical trans people. It's been a total wonderful journey in that respect and just having those conversations with so many wonderful people. I want to thank Nettie Smith, who has been editing this podcast since the 14th episode when I was like, actually, I am not capable of doing this myself. Nettie, you've done such a wonderful job. You've never missed a deadline. You have slayed every episode you've been with us through. I've recorded in so many jank places. The Toronto Public Library has been a major. I've recorded most of the podcast here. And when the Toronto Public Library's computer network went down last fall, there was a cyber ransom attack. Nettie was like, all right, let's have you record at home and make it as good as we can be. Gosh. So thanks to both Nettie and the Toronto Public Library. I want to thank James Frankie Thomas, who accompanied me on my first research trip to the Alcott Archives at Harvard and in Concord, and was the first guest on this episode. It was sort of like the person who made me think we could do a podcast. Christine Jacobson, who is the organizer of the Alcott Archive at Harvard, who helped me with that research and very generously asked if I'd be willing to donate the podcast production materials to Harvard, and I will, and they will be available at Harvard now, which is crazy.
That's good.
I know. And my editors at the New York Times, Oprah Daily, LGBTQ Nation, who supported me in writing about this project and opening this up for public dialogue. So thank you to all of you, everyone who's guested, everyone who's listened. Thank you so much. And this is the last episode. So all that said, Bree, Ray, where can people buy Meg, Joe, Beth, and Amy? Where can they find you online? How can they support your work? What's going on?
You can find the book anywhere. I mean, it's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, but I 100% think you should go to your indie bookstores because they are wonderful. There are so many queer bookstores that are out there and they're supporting queer stories. And it's just amazing. There's so much book love right now. So yeah, definitely buy indie. And if they don't have it, they can order it for you. Yeah. And there are actually, I think, bookstores. I just talked to Children's Book World the other day here in Los Angeles, and they were like, Meg, Joe, Beth, and Amy still sells so often. So could you send more book plates where?
Yes.
Yeah. So
evergreen. Indie bookstores. Sorry. Indie bookstores. Yes.
Okay. And what about you, Rex? Where can they find you?
Oh, I'm on Instagram at Third Rex, spelled out THIRDREX, because I'm Rex the Third and the Third Rex in my family.
Slay.
The Third Rex. Mm-hmm. You can find me at BreeIndigo.com, B-R-E, and then the word indigo. Mm-hmm. I'm currently working on book two of The Dog Night.
Woo!
And so it's going to be 2 of 3. I'm really excited. I'm trying to get it out there. And you can keep up with me with any of that news and also news about my webcomic Jamie and any other future projects by following me on Instagram mostly right now until a Twitter alternative settles down.
Yes.
And it's Bree Indigo at any social media as well.
Yeah, so that's me.
Okay. And we did a second book, North Ranger, which I just want to give a shout out to because it's based on Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey, but it's queer.
That rules. Okay.
The Texas Cowboys.
That's
it was a lot of fun to work on. We did it together.
Yes.
Yeah. Gay Cowboys. Now we just need to find a third project to work on, which I'm very excited about. And just between us, and no one steal this idea if you're listening. I've already started work on Theo Blake, Nate, and Dan, which is a modern reimagining of Louisa May Alcott's Little Men.
Yeah.
I don't know what'll happen, but Bree, I've got you in my side.
I'm here.
Yeah. Well,
all right, cool.
That is extremely exciting. Hard launch on the podcast. Jeez.
And now it's out there.
Okay.
Resonate.
Well, as always, I'm your host, Peyton Thomas. You can find me online at peytonthomas.ca. The podcast is over, but I am still hard at work on my own book, my own adaptation of Little Women.
Yeah.
So that should be what I'm going to do right after I finish recording is go into a little mole hole in the floor and write that and not come out till it's done.
So excited for that.
Yes.
I have a number of other projects on the go. I'm working on another YA for Penguin, which I hope to have more news about soon. So stay in touch. Don't be a stranger. I have loved doing this podcast and getting to know all of you. Thank you so much for listening and take care of yourselves and tell a friend about this show. All right.